After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Real Change series on the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg. Inspired by Sharon's newest book, Real Change, this series features conversations with activists, artists, and teachers, all discussing the intersection of meditation and social action. To learn more, visit realchangebook.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm speaking today with teacher and author Joelle L. Daniels for the Real Change podcast series. Joelle, also known as Joelle Leon, is a performer, author, and storyteller who writes and tells stories for Black people. Born and raised in the Bronx, Joelle specializes in moderating and leading conversations surrounding race, masculinity, mental health, creativity, and the performing arts, with love as the center of his work and purpose. He is the author of Book About Things I Will Tell My Daughter and God Wears Durags Too. His recent TED Talk on healthy co-parenting has been viewed over 1.2 million times globally. He's worked with the Gates Foundation, HBO, The Today Show, BBC News, Sirius XM, Forbes, The Huffington Post, and others. And the one and only Lin-Manuel Miranda says, Joelle's words are where I go when I need some inspiration, and he never lets me down. I'm so delighted to welcome you to the Metta Hour, Joelle.
I'm so glad to be here for the Metta Hour. Sharon, I also paid Lin-Manuel to say that for me. So, shout out to Lin.
Well, I spend a lot of time on Twitter, and that's where I found you. That's where I found your work. And I was trying to think back. I was probably, since I do follow Lin-Manuel Miranda, and he might have retweeted you or commented on something.
I can tell you that is exactly what happened. You can't pinpoint the date that we began following each other. But I definitely remember, like, it was one of the first times Lin had started retweeting me. Because I've known Lin for a little bit, and we had just started following each other on Twitter. And I remember being like, oh, who's this, like, looking at some of the cool people who were following me back, and then, like, you popped up. And I was like, oh, wow, this is super awesome.
That's fantastic. Well, recently, because I retweet you a lot, somebody had written, I can't remember who this was, said, I feel like some kind of weird stalker. Can I possibly retweet every single thing he posts? And I thought, oh my God, I do too. Like, first of all, you say it faster than I can. You know, like sometimes I'm struggling, like, how do I say this? What do I want to impart? And it's so beautiful, truly, everything you put out there. And I think I'm just going to retweet him. I don't have to bother writing anything.
I'm glad we're recording this so I can save it and play it for my children when they become adults, so I can tell them that Sharon said, because that is the most humbling thing I think I've heard. Because I think you are such a wellspring of knowledge and spirit energy. So to hear that from you is wonderful, and I'm grateful. I'm super grateful to be able to, like, hold that kind of space for you and for us that way. That's dope.
Well, you really do. I mean, of course, I connected so strongly with the things you were writing because of love and how hard it is sometimes to talk about love, or how essential. And, the last book I wrote, not the one that's just out, but was called Real Love. And in it, I was talking about this quote from a movie, Dan in Real Life, which I had seen a lot of times.
Oh my God.
You know, because my goddaughter had like a tiny little part in it. And so I saw it a lot of times. And there's this quote in it, which is one of the characters says, love is not a feeling, it's an ability. Love is not a feeling, it's an ability. And I really love that because, of course, love is a feeling as well. But when it's an ability, it's not in someone else's hands to give to us or take away from us. It's really inside us. And and then it's also our responsibility if we want to nurture it and bring it forth and so on.
Yeah. And like you read my mind because I think that's where I immediately go to. It's something that we can like hone. You know, it's a muscle. But really it's a skill set. And I think the more we can kind of view love through that lens, and also, you know, like a lot of the work I've been trying to do as far as my creative practice has been not removing, but in addition to love being viewed from like the romantic lens that I think especially Hollywood tends to portray love as, it's really about the ability to love in various scenarios and situations, like whether it be platonic, familial, love of work, like love in the pursuit or this love of the process of whatever your work is, whether it be the meditative practice or your 9-to-5 work or the work of parenting, right? Because of that in and of itself is a job, but being able to view it as an ability allows us to stretch too, right? Like you can maximize the opportunities in which love gets to exist. And I love that framing of it because that ownership part of it is so important, because I think we tend to forget we have autonomy. We have so much autonomy when it comes to talking about love, being in love, being of service to others while in love, whatever that looks like for us. Yeah, that's great.
I'll tell you a secret. I'll tell the world a secret once I tell you a secret. I guess this is not a private conversation.
Or is it, Sharon?
Good point. So I wrote this book, Real Love, and it's all in a way based around that one sentence. Love is not a feeling, it's an ability, and the empowerment of that and everything. And then I turned it in and the editor said to me, "You didn't finish the book." And I said, "Of course I finished the book. That's why I turned it in." And she said, no, you just like told a story and then you drifted off somewhere. You have to finish the book." And I could not finish that book. I kept staring at the screen. I couldn't finish the book. And then the presidential election of 2016 happened and I finished the book in 15 minutes. Really? I finished the book in 15 minutes. I just thought, if love is an ability, it's also a responsibility. So what's my responsibility now?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. You see that? That's that powerful stuff that you're talking about, that you do so well. It's what is my responsibility now? And I love that because, and I feel like you are the person, and what I would encourage everyone to be able to do is to keep coming back to that. I feel like we negotiate ways in which we live in love or anything that we decide to call love. Passion point bombs, right? Like we negotiate it and make a decision about that thing in year one, right? So like we make a decision about, okay, this is some fucked up shit. Like where a lot of us are not happy about it. How do I show up now, right? Like where's the opportunity for me to show up in love and not love in the love that you're talking about is not passive, you know? And again, I think it goes back to this romantic, like the romanticized ways in which we view love. And you're talking about, okay, I'm going to use this love in a very proactive, challenging way, almost. And it's easy to not see love as that. I think we tend to view love from this lens of an inactive process of just being and heart-shaped emojis and googly eyes, as opposed to there's some real transformative work happening here if we're looking at it as an opportunity and a responsibility in the times when we're afforded to.
That's really beautiful. You're in New York City right now?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. How is it there?
Hot. It is hot. Yeah. I mean, granted, I mean, the AC is on blast. I don't know how our electricity bills are so low, they've been relatively low these past few months, but it is hot. And, you know, I'm self-quarantining now. I went to visit my eldest daughter, Lila, in Houston. And Houston is out of control. So, you know, you sign a form when you're on the plane, on the flight back to New York. The CDC is literally waiting for you like they're concierge. You get off the plane. Oh, wow. Yeah, like to get the forms from you to make sure you filled it out. And then I have to self-quarantine for 14 days until I can be out.
And what day are you up to right now?
I do not know. Jerry, that is a very good question.
You're not counting. You're so good.
No, I'm just winging
it. Just in the moment?
Yeah, I'm just winging it. I'm like, I think it's day 10, maybe. I'm a born and raised New Yorker too. So like the situation we're in now, even outside of just the self quarantine, just businesses being closed and some people not really following appropriate guidelines and, you know, for whatever reasons that they might have. Some of that's been a little troubling, but it's also been encouraging, I think, to see people come together in spite of circumstances, you know, in that way.
Well, I'm in Barre, Massachusetts, where the retreat center I co-founded is next door through the forest, and it's closed, of course. And I have an apartment in New York that I rent, and I spent the month of February in California, and then I came back to New York, and I just, in early March, and I was just like, this doesn't feel good, you know?
I feel
so tense, and I'm getting anxious, and I have a house up here. And I thought, I'll go up to Barre for a couple of weeks, you know? So I came up with my snow boots, and and I've been here ever since. And I've only left this property. I have a house, and there's some woods, and, you know, next door to the center. And I've only left the property once because I had to go to a local clinic for some routine blood tests. And I even, there was a couple outside the clinic not wearing masks. So I even got to be annoyed at that, you know? Wait a minute, this is like a tiny little world I have now. differently.
Yeah. It's, you know, when I left, so like similar, I mean, granted, not similar like that, I'm not in Massachusetts, but when, you know, I have a 9-to-5 job. And so when I have two children, right? So like my daughter, Wes, was born January 25th. And COVID hadn't really hit New York, right? And so, but in the ways that at least we knew of. And so, you know, I had some paternity leave. I come back to the office, and right around the time I come back is when our agency was kind of ahead of the curve and issued the mandate, like, hey, listen, we think it's time for everyone to just work from home. And I took a couple of things from the office, right? Because I'm like, gee, the same exact thing, Sharon. It's going to be a couple of weeks, 3 weeks maybe. And then, you know, that turned into July. And, you know, we're still working from home. And I'm glad you said what you said about it didn't feel right, because even in that period of March, I was feeling a lot of discomfort. And I want to, and to be honest and frank, I felt like I had fallen into a bit of a depression. And really what it felt like was, I'm not going to try to self-diagnose myself, but there was some real hangs and tensions of attention of surrounding me being a father for the second time, and really disconnected from West at that point. And it was easy for me to kind of beat myself up about it, as opposed to recognizing, to your point, like March was just a really heavy month, you know, like a lot was shifting. And thank you just saying that, I think, gave me more freedom to give myself grace. So I appreciate you for doing that without even knowing. But
thank you.
That's fine.
It was, you know, and I feel like in some ways, I was just sensitive to a kind of collective energy. I feel like I was actually ahead of the curve a little bit. Like,
for sure.
I got really anxious and I left. And then I was being interviewed on the show, and they said to me, are you feeling a lot of anxiety? And I said, no, I feel so much sadness. And that was before, you know, kind of the grief really hit. And then I thought, and then I'm just tired. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm just like mapping it out for people or something.
I think you were ahead of the curve on that. And I mean, granted, I don't love you being sad, but I think even when we look at love as an ability and really a choice too, right? And a responsibility, all those things, I think outside of some level of chemical chemical imbalance, right? Or some like diagnosis. It's really, we do kind of have the choice to decide how we get to show up for the moment. You know, I could be anxious about it. You know, there's a lot to, I think, to be anxious about, rightfully so. And for those who are anxious, like, that's completely fine. I also, for me, in a similar way, I think I was trying to recognize and also be able to reconcile was like, this is a very different moment, a moment I've never experienced before. And honestly, this is the busiest I've ever been.
I agree.
Right. And I think, and I know I'm speaking for both of us when I say this, and it's like, you bringing up 2016 and in recognizing the responsibility and love as an ability, I think shows itself in this period now, where I think you're probably being called upon and asked to do the work that you've always been doing, except in a bigger and broader way. You know, because I think that's what the community is calling for. And the community I felt like was treating love and healing as kind of a side dish, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's all these other things you have to worry about. You have to worry about bills, household, parenting. It's like, oh, you know, I'll meditate a little bit, but I'll get to the healing and like love thy neighbor and love myself, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I'll get to that later. And it's like, oh, I have to be home all the time with all of the things.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. Let me call Sharon. You know, like,
yeah, right. Anytime, man. We had like a karmic breakthrough. We're actually talking to each other instead of tweeting at each other. You know,
yeah.
You know, anytime.
But I think that's it. It's like we're at a place now where the folks who have been, I think, trying to show up and do the consistent work of healing are being asked to kind of expand. And it's actually, for me, it's been interesting and really cool to see people really trying to lean in, even if they don't know how, you know?
Because I think for me, like, a big part of that understanding, you know, that I've come to is that, like, I know even when I said I felt anxious, some people are going to be disappointed. Like, oh, you feel anxiety too. You've been meditating for nearly 50 years. But, you know, that's not the point. It's not so much what comes up, but how we relate to what comes up, you know? And so can I love myself anyway? Can I have some space? Some spaciousness around these things. Can I not project, oh, this is the way I'm going to be forever, or I'm the only one, you know? Can I not hold it in isolation, but understand I'm part of like the larger community of people, and we're going through a lot, and it's fine that, you know, all these things arise, and we have such an opportunity to relate differently to everything we're going through. And also, you know, to be with the painful feelings differently, and not forget, not just overlook the joy, and that there's goodness also.
And I think, and I mean, so beautifully said. And I hear that, and what I think about too, and it's been coming up in a lot of conversations I've been having, like that balancing act, right? Mm-hmm. Of being cognizant and fully aware that yes, there was trauma here, there's pain here. There's loss, grief, suffering, right? All these things. And there's also, again, like the word I feel like that kind of keeps coming up outside of ability is also opportunity and responsibility, mm-hmm. right? Like there's also an opportunity here. You know, for me, the goal has really become, like part of my creative practices has really become like dismantling systems creatively, systems that oppress marginalized people. And we tend to look at government systems directly as opposed to like, how is patriarchy contributing to our oppression? How is misogyny contributing to our oppression? How is the way we talk about masculinity, the way we talk about race, the way we even talk about art, or don't talk about art in the ways it can heal? And how do we kind of dismantle the old ways of thinking? But part of that is being able to see there's an opportunity amidst the trauma and the grief to show up in a way that is most aligned with where we want to go. And also in what you're talking about is like not a fixed view of that either, right? It's I can see maybe the despair and the pain and the angst in this space and period, but I also know that there's something that lives outside of that can be joyous. And I can hold space for both of those things.
Mm-hmm.
even without taking away from the energy that those things bring, you know, and not making light. Because I think sometimes it's easy for us to think, if I'm happy, if I'm choosing to be happy in this space, I'm just being ignorant of the pain that's that's happening alongside of it. It's like, that's not the case at all.
That's really beautiful. You're reminding me of this part of my book, which I should have let you write because you're great.
Please share.
But
please.
Anyway, you know, this is part of my book where I've been invited down to Florida to the Parkland community to teach. And this was the first time that I was there. And there was a young woman who was not at the school the day of the shooting, but her mother was. She was a teacher and she was fine, but they didn't know that, of course, for many hours, and it was devastating anyway. And she said to me, you know, I'm having a really strange experience here in this day of practice, because she said, it's really wonderful, and it feels really incredible, and I know the only reason it's happening is because that horrible thing happened, and I don't know how to get over that to really appreciate this. And I said, you know, I don't think you get over it. I think you hold them both.
Yeah.
You know, that somehow we have to have space for both to be true, because they are both true.
Yeah, yeah. And I think sometimes we do a poor job of holding, you know, and holding and not clinging, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, because it's easy to fall into the trap of clinging, even the good stuff. And, you know, I know I'm preaching to the choir here with you, but the idea of, like, we hold on to the things. And then we try to not hold on to the pain, right? It's like, I don't want to be with that. And it's like, well, exactly to your point, you can, two things can be true at the same time. You know, like Trump can be an asshole, and Trump can also have some, like, based on the memo, like based on his niece's, you know, like there could be some trauma attached to that.
And
it's something I've been trying to communicate to people so often, Sharon. It's when we talk about forgiveness, and people tend to think forgiveness is about lack of accountability. And for me, it's like, no, forgiveness means you're holding people directly accountable and responsible for the behavior. And what that means is then I can still hold two truths together. Like, you could you could have done something that's very shitty, but then also I can recognize maybe you put together a book sale drive for the kids in the community who didn't have them. You know, like that. Like people get to be more than one thing, and these situations get to be more than one thing too, which is what I think you're also talking about, which I would love for us to kind of start believing in more, because then we wouldn't be so hard on ourselves, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true, because we're more than one thing ourselves.
Right. Yeah, like even just like chemically. You know, like we are made up of so many different things, and it's easy to kind of start focusing in on either the things we despise most about ourselves or the things that we think, quote unquote, need the most work, as opposed to just being able to hold those things and not cling to them in a way that allows everything to live in that space, you know, without taking away. They don't take away from each other, you know?
So great. So let's talk about art for a minute. I was really struck by what you were saying a little bit earlier, because I was, it's also like a big, you haven't seen the book yet, but you will. It's actually like a big theme in the book, because I was talking to Bell Hooks, and I was in Kentucky, and
You can't just be saying stuff like that casually.
Names.
Like, you know, what's up? You know, I was talking to Bella Hooks. You know,
yeah, right.
What? That's amazing. I'm sorry. Continue.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I was, you know, I grew up in New York City. I was born in the Bronx too. I grew up in Washington Heights, and then I went to college.
How did we not have this conversation? What?
I don't know. We haven't had a conversation.
This is true. But yeah, that's wild. Continue. I'm sorry.
So I grew up in Washington Heights. I went to college in Buffalo. I'm a product of the New York City public school system. So I skipped two grades. I went to school when I was 16, when I was 16. Nice. Went to India when I was 18 because there was an independent study program at my university in Buffalo that allowed you to go somewhere for a year if you could create a project. And said, I want to go to India and study meditation. They said, okay. So I went, which of course was the beginning of my whole life, my whole real life. And came back as a teacher a little more than a year later. Although I did come back and finish school, and I went back, and then I came back as a teacher and was teaching. And I was writing this book called Faith, which came out about 18 years ago, almost exactly. And I wanted to leave Barry and just go somewhere else. And his friend offered me an apartment in New York City because she was coming up here to do a retreat. And so I went there really for the first time as an adult in living there. And I loved it. It was so meaningful for me. And somewhere I heard that Bell Hooks had quoted me, which I thought was like the honor of a lifetime.
Oh,
I met her. And so we became friends, and we used to go out to dinner. And then she moved back to Kentucky, which is where she'd grown up, and we completely lost touch. And then just a few years ago, I was renting this apartment, and so, I don't know, there was no water. So I don't know, there was some kind of problem. And so I checked into this little hotel in the neighborhood, and there was Bell Hooks sitting in the lobby. She was coming in to teach at the new school, and they would put her up there. And so we renewed our friendship, and
that's awesome.
And we really bonded. So whenever she was coming to New York, I would see her. And then, although I must say, I don't think this is telling tales out of school. She's a little hard to keep in touch with because she doesn't do email. And she doesn't even have a cell phone. She like borrows a neighbor's cell phone when she travels.
What's up with these great things? Like Fran Lebowitz is the same thing. Like she's really? she has a house phone. That's it.
Yeah.
Like, no email. It's like, okay, thanks, I guess.
So because she borrows a neighbor's cell phone, it's always like a different number, you know? Like, I don't even know what she's using. But anyway, awesome. I have her number in Kentucky, so it worked out. So I went there to teach, and I was working on this book, Real Change, which is about mindfulness, loving kindness, and social change. And I use the term social action, and Bell, who I find of all the people I know, is maybe the most exacting and precise about the use of language. Like, no, don't say that. Say it this way. Or what do you mean by that? That's unclear, or that's misleading, or something. And so she told me she didn't like the term social action. And she said because for her it implied a very narrow stream of activity, like protesting. She said, what about art? Art is one of the greatest means of social change. And isn't that what we mean by social action? So that became a whole theme in the book.
It's hard for me to speak. I got misty-eyed a little when you said that, because to hear Bell Hooks say that, for me, just affirms the life's work that I feel like I'm dedicating myself to. You know, I just finished reading Freedom Dreams by Dr. Robin D.G. Kelly. And essentially he's talking about the Black imagination and the ability of the Black imagination to reimagine the future. And he opens the book and talks about poetry as a form of social protest and really viewing social justice and the work of social justice through the lens of poetry, and that how poetry is so free form and so open. If we can view movement in that way, the amount of work we'd be able to do and accomplish is staggering. And so I spent a lot of time feeling like before I read the book, and even hearing this quote now that you shared with me from Bell, I spent a lot of time really just not being sure if my art meant something to the revolution and to the work. And even when I think of the Nikki Giovanni's and the Sonia Sanchez's and, you know, the Amiri Baraka's, these individuals that I think really own the space for revolutionary art, you know, Audre Lorde. It's hard for, I think, ourselves in the moment, you know, to see if we are doing the work of our ancestors, you know, like Zora Neale Hurston's and the Langston Hughes, right, of the world. And but I think if taking it away from that, as an aside, it's the things that have been most meaningful to me that have encouraged me to be more active in the community, to be more active in my process, has come from artists, has come from art, whether it be from spoken word artists, hip hop artists, theater, art, you know, in just poetry, you know, like it's consistently inspired me to look and reach for different ways of communicating. You know, Chuck D, he had and him and Tupac said similar things about this. And really it was, Chuck D said, like, I'm not Malcolm X, but I hope to inspire the next mind that will be, you know, and Tupac said something similar about, you know, I might not change the world, but I'm going to inspire the next person to do so. And for me, that's something I've always tried to own. Like, I don't know who I am right now in this moment besides, you know, a Black father, Black man, you know, brother, whomever, an artist who's just trying to give everyone the space to feel, to sift, to be with, and to also deconstruct, you know, the ways that we view not just art, but society, and how art can be a catalyst for that. I wrote a piece recently called Poetry Will Save the World, because I believe it. And I think the more I can believe in that, I think the more it can potentially become true. And so that's kind of my hope, that, you know, we're all poems. I say that a lot, I think, sometimes on Twitter or just like in verse. You know, I think every single one of us is a poem. I think we all have a poem in us. And the more we can be less judgmental about how that poem manifests itself in the world, I think the better we will be, and the better art we will be able to make. Granted, you know, I think better is subjective, but the idea that the more we're just allowing ourselves to be liberated and detached from the way we're supposed to show up, supposed to, quote unquote, show up for, the more, the better we will be as a society, I think. And I think art can be the driving force for that.
I totally agree. I think art is, and for many of us, it's the greatest driving force of that. And I'll tell you another story that's in the book or image. Yes. I was at Emory University in the audience when the Dalai Lama and Alice Walker and Richard Gere were on this panel about art and creativity. The talk was sponsored by the art department. And the first question was a question I'm asked all the time, actually, about different things. But basically it was, do you think great art has to come from great suffering? Mm-hmm. Or can it come from another place? And
yeah.
You know, and Alice Walker said some really interesting things about believing that when she was younger, but now felt that the happier she got, the better her poetry was getting.
Yeah.
And Richard Gere talked about being an angry young man. And then the Dalai Lama was so cute, as he often is. He said, basically, he didn't quite understand the question because it made no sense to him. And he said, you know, people are always dragging me places and say, look at this building, look at this painting, you know, isn't it wonderful? Isn't it beautiful? And he said, in Tibet, we believe the worth or the merit of a piece of art depends on what happens internally to the creator as they are making it. So if the artist becomes kinder, more enlightened, more aware, that's considered great art. And I thought, that's different, you know?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, that's, I'm so glad we're recording so I can just keep listening to all these things so I can write them down. Like, Sharon, it's, you know, there's like a tradition in like the Black community where they tell you to be careful about the kind of art you bring home, right? And maybe this is also similar in other communities, but like, you know, like if someone's making a thing, like if someone's painted you a picture or sculpted something, to be aware of the energy of whomever made that thing, like what space they were in when they were creating. You know, because like you don't want to bring bad spirits into your household, like things of that nature. And so and the Dalai Lama say that for me also speaks to, I think, and like just thinking specifically for myself, where I am as an artist and knowing that I'm making some of the best art of my life. And like I'm in the most secure place I've ever been. You know, financially, spiritually, mentally. And I think part of that is because I'm in a, I'm in a place where I get to hold space for all of the things, you know, like the grief, the trauma, the joy, the loss, the accomplishments. It's all here and I'm here for it all. And so my art, I think is reflective of that now, as opposed to maybe, I think when we're younger, we try to hide certain parts and we only put out the shiny things, or my heart is broken. And so like it's writing for me when my heart was broken was cathartic. Performing, like being on stage, whether it be emceeing or doing spoken word, theater, whatever. If I was going through something, I was troubling at home or at school or in the workplace or in a relationship, then being on stage definitely was very like therapeutic for me. But I don't necessarily know if I was making the best art at that time, as opposed to now where A, it is cathartic, but it's also, it's coming from a place of joy. Mm. You know, even in the depths of sadness, there's still this piece of joy. Like I'm having opportunity to share my gift, right? And my ability, you know, right? Like, because I think it goes hand in hand with the love that you talked about, you know, and Dan in real life. Again, which is such a phenomenal movie. I'm so glad you brought that movie up because I feel like but you know, like art has been like, I've been able to make art from a happy place and it feels really good.
Well, it makes me think, you know, like, where does our greatest courage come from? Hmm. You know, because that's, I said this in the book too, you know, that's what I count on from artists. It's like not their misery, it's their courage, you know, step out and, you know, be bold and different, you know, help me see things in a different way. And that's very courageous. And that's what I rely on. And maybe our sense of wholeness can also make us courageous.
Yeah, I think absolutely. And I think furthermore, and I love what you just said, and it makes me think about how we define what courageousness is. You know, we like, especially in this period now, it's, you know, shout out to the essential workers, to the frontline workers, whether it be healthcare, retail, grocery, you know, all those spaces, all those people who are being very courageous. And I think, I don't want to say heroic because I also think that almost taints the work, and it also speaks to like capitalism and why they even have to work in the first place, right? But I think when I think about courage, I also think about single mothers, or I think about the person that's decided to be with whatever is happening in that moment. You know, like if you're being, because it's hard. I think it's we tend to downplay how hard it is to show up as you are, you know, because the world may judge you for it, and that could be scary. You know, being vulnerable is not easy, you know, and it takes a level of courage to be vulnerable on a page, to be vulnerable in a conversation, to be vulnerable in many different ways and dynamics. And so wanting to, what I try to remind people of is to again, give yourself more grace, but then also to recognize just breathing, you know, and being with your breath takes an act of courage too, because you're now surrendering to the fact that you, like, breathing happens so automatically. You don't even think about it. And so taking the time to really be with that, I feel like it's just as important, and giving ourselves the freedom to feel courageous about these small acts of courage, right? That I think take place on a daily basis.
So did you learn, like, all this, what I find really awesome wisdom about life just from life? Or did you like have teachers? Or,
I mean, I think, you know, spirit, you know, like, I wish I would have known if you work a lot sooner, it would have saved me a lot of grief, if we're being honest. I think, you know, Buddhism played a really big part in the self-discovery process for me, Sharon. Like, you know, I was baptized in the Catholic Church. My mom isn't a strict Catholic at all. Like, we didn't go to service, none of that stuff. My mom very much prays to saints. And that's a thing for her. But my older sister, who I didn't know I had an older sister until I was about 10 from my father's side. She, you know, and she lives out in Indianapolis with my brother-in-law, and she's a Baptist, grew up in the South, and so I would go to church with her. And so, like, that kind of started me on this path towards a religious practice. Like, I was reading the Bible faithfully during those summers I spent in Indiana. And I got to a point maybe in high school, and I think some of us get to that point, and I part of my work has also been trying to uncover why, and maybe we'll have another conversation about this, because I would love to get your insights on, like, how do people decide to be aware? You know, like, what is the catalyst? Like, how do you, because I'm very curious as to And granted, we can't control this, but I wish we could to a certain extent, if I'm being honest. But like, how do we make unaware, quote unquote, people aware? You know, like, how do you make a person aware of the things that they don't know, that they're unaware of? But I got to a point where I felt very aware of like the practice and being like, there's more here. It's more than just like Islamic faith or Judaism or Christianity. There's something else. And I can't remember how I stumbled upon dharmaseed.org, but I feel like I was looking for something and like just kind of talk. So like meditations, I was trying to get to a space. There was a lot of friction happening in my life at the time. And I found it and you know, the Dharma spoke to me, you know, in a way that like kind of said, okay, this feels like something A, I can implement. And then also too, for me, it's even less sharing about the practice on the mat. You know, I would hear Dharma talks anyway, and a lot of it was, you know, don't forget to take this practice with you off the mat. And for me, it was reverse. You know, I started trying to take the practice off the mat first. And then it's been more about coming to the mat and like giving myself the time to sit and be still. But really it was like, how do I take all these nuggets of like, of knowledge, of wisdom, of self-discovery, of love, and bring those things into my art, into the world, into my relationships. And, you know, I'm still failing at it, like maybe 50% of the time. I think I'm enjoying the process and the practice of it, but in all honesty, Buddhism guided me. And then like, the more I was able to kind of throw shit to the wall and use life experience as a gauge to how much I'm learning, it's kind of like they work hand in hand, I think, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It makes total sense. And it's wonderful. Cause I think obviously for me, you know, it was so essential, and it happened to be the language in which I learned a sense of possibility, you know, that things didn't have to be as they were. Like if I was going to use one word to describe myself when I was 18 and on my way to India, I would say fragmented, you know, I was just all over the place. I had no sense of a kind of core to my being. And I wove myself together in the loving environment that meditation practice actually provided for me. And plus there was a lot within Buddhism, just the way things were expressed that I found breathtaking, you know, like anybody can do the practice. Anybody can be free within. And, you know, you don't have to be born a certain status. You don't have to be a certain gender. You don't, you know, anybody.
And
I think, you know, just because of my life experience as a child, you know, I felt very kind of left out of things. And it was like the first time I thought, oh, me too, you know, look at that.
Yeah. That is the exact same sentiment. It got to a place where it's like, oh, wait. And it's like sometimes, okay, this is maybe a bad example, but I had a cut recently, yesterday. I was just walking around the apartment and like my ankle started burning a little. And I was like, why is this burning? Like, where am I ankle? What happened? And then I looked and I kept walking back and forth, and then it was still tingling a little bit. And I looked down and I had a cut, like some skin had broke a little. And I was like, when did this happen? How did this happen? And Buddhism for me pointed me exactly to where the thing was. You know, like I didn't, like before I was struggling to know where or how Buddhism gave me a foundation to be able to point to the thing and describe it accurately, to give it texture, to be able to say, okay, I don't even need to resolve this. It's not about solving it or answering the question, but it just allowed me to sit with everything like in this most amazing way. So the things that I don't know, I can go, okay. You know, even the things that I do know, I can also go, okay. You know, do I know that? Or maybe, I don't know, I'm not sure. And being okay with the not knowing, as opposed to my very Capricorn tendency to want to plan 18 steps ahead, which works well for me as a rapper. You know, when I'm freestyle rapping and I have to think of 10 words ahead of time so I can make them rhyme, that's fun. But planning
Do you think of the words ahead of time in order to rap?
Absolutely. So like when, if I'm, so like if I'm, and this is what, and you know, I would love to, Lynn and I never had a conversation about the process of freestyling, but it's such a, it's a science, you know, like Sharon, I compare it to, granted, I don't play chess, but I know how chess works for the most part. And I've always compared freestyle rapping, like just making words up on the spot, to chess, because in chess, you're thinking, if you're playing chess in a competitive way, you're thinking at least three moves ahead of your competitor. And for me, as an MC, when I was on, if someone puts a beat on or instrumental, and they just add like, hey, say something off the top of your head, and I'm like, okay, well, you know, I'll start rapping, and then I'll say, okay, well, what word? Okay, let's say if I say glue, in my head, I'm thinking, okay, new through. Like as I'm rapping these words, I'm also trying to set up examples for the next word so that it feels linear. You know, and it tells like there's a through line to the rap, as opposed to, hey, I never liked raps, like freestyle rap sounding like I didn't know what I was doing. So very early on, I dedicated myself to, I would just rap all the time. And mainly because I was lazy, I didn't want to write. So I didn't want to write, so I would just have to make up rhymes all the time, to the point that I got really good at it. But part of the practice for me was, how can I set these words up? You know, so that I don't have to, it makes it a little easier to like go through that process.
That's so interesting. You know, the group he co-founded, Freestyle Love Supreme, has this academy where they train people to rap. Yeah. So my friend that I had gone to see a performance with, she just sent me an email and she said, want to go, you know? And I wrote back and I said, I'd love to go, but I'm so busy.
Yeah, you are super busy. But shout out to Jelly Donut. Shout out to Anthony. Like everyone, like that academy is wonderful. The work that they're doing, and really, you know, bringing art to the masses. For people who, there are people who have misgivings about Hamilton, and I understand. I get it. But what I think what Lynn and what Tommy were able to accomplish with that art was put hip hop in a position where people were having a conversation about the art of it, you know, the art. And for me, that's what was most important. People having a conversation about it. And also, I think it opened the door for a broader conversation about what is Broadway, you know, like what does it take to be a Broadway musical? And even for me, you know, because I hadn't even been thinking about writing anything that was remotely close to a play or something. And Hamilton, for me, was like, okay, this is possible. Even if it doesn't have music in it, we can start having conversations about what the culture looks like on stage. You know, Saul Williams, he had done, I think, Holla If You Hear Me. I forget the name of I think it was a musical that he tried to bring to Broadway, and it failed miserably. And I don't think it was any fault of Saul. I just think Broadway has done a very piss poor job of adjusting to the times, and it wasn't marketed properly. But I think Lynn's opened a floodgate where now, you know, granted, maybe not now because of COVID, but, you know, when you look at it, like when you look at a slave play and you look at these other things that are coming to Broadway that wouldn't have been Be More Chill. This stuff wouldn't have been coming up on Broadway 4 years ago, you know, 5 years ago. But I think what I love about that is what art can do, and really what freestyle rapping can do, and how it's improv, it's just as important, I think, when we talk about theatrical training and ensemble work. It's just as important as STEM training. It's just as important as sports, sports communities. Like it does something that is very impactful to the youth. Like, I don't know where I would have been if I didn't have the opportunity to study theater and to have art acting teachers and to have art cultivated in me, especially from the hood I come from, you know, like Bronx too, Fordham Road, Preston Avenue, you know, 188. Mm-hmm. Like there's, you know, opportunity is nil to none, especially in the era I grew up in the 80s. Jeremy, talking Reaganomics, we're talking crack, we're talking a whole lot of things that were hitting the Bronx hard. But art gave me a space to be myself, to be this light skinned, kind of dorky, little husky on the husky side, kid with a gap. You know, who was kind of funny, but I didn't really have a place, it felt like, but art gave that to me.
It's so amazing. Well, in the grateful acknowledgments I wrote for Real Love, I tell the story about when a friend brought me to see Hamilton. And I was working on Real Love, and I was incredibly discouraged, and I was really late. And I was just in a really bad way about it. And I had the terrible thought, the truly terrible thought, just turn it in. You know, this is your 10th book. Nobody cares what you have to say anymore. I'm really being honest with you. This is very self-disclosing to the world now. And I said, you know, I just said, just turn it in. Just phone it in. Just turn it in. And this friend, you know, was coming through town, and he worked in the music industry. And he said, you know, I can get tickets to whatever you'd like to see. What would you like to see? So I said, oh, Hamilton. I didn't know, you know, like it was so hard to get and so expensive. And so we went to see Hamilton, and I was mesmerized. And I just thought, Lin-Manuel Miranda was still in it. And I kept looking at him thinking, you wrote this. Like, this came out of your head. And I thought, you can never just turn something in. You can never just phone it in. Everything you do, you have to put everything you've got into it. And my friend still teases me. He said, and then I turned to you and I said, do you want to go out to dinner? And you said, I have to go home and write.
So, you were inspired. And that's inspired. That is the beauty of the work, you know? And I think of all the Latinx kids and the other black and brown kids who got to see, whether or not you agree with, you know, David playing like a slave owner or Lynn playing a slave owner. Yes. And again, it just kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier, right? Two things can be true at the same time. To be able to see David rapping, like even like I say now and I almost get emotional, like to see him rapping on stage and not like, you know, I don't know. I don't, not like silly rapping, but like rapping, you know, and it's also cool because I think about Lynn often because, you know, my daughter Lila loves Moana. And oh, so the thing is like, if you're an artist and you're paying attention, I can hear Lynn in the songs. Like Lynn writes in a, and it's something that only happens. I mean, it happens in other places too, because you can hear a musical and know like who wrote what if you're a studier of that. I'm not, but like I know there's a community of people who know. But like in hip hop, if I hear a Pharrell record or if I hear a Timbaland record, I know that they produced it and they wrote it. Because there's a certain way that they write and produce music. There's a certain way Lynn writes songs. You know, like I can hear like this cadence, is his tone. Like in the characters. And, you know, if he would have phoned that in, we wouldn't have had a Hamilton or, you know, like, and I think it's what I love about that too, is that you being patient with your process, you know, which I think younger me was such a brat about that, you know, like, you know, like needing things to happen right now. And it, if it doesn't happen this exact way, which again, Buddhism helped because Buddhism allowed me to detach from the outcome. Like, and there's a tendency to think detaching from the outcome means a lack of care for the outcome, as opposed to I'm not clinging to this as a way of being or this needing to be a certain way in order for me to be happy with the result. You know, like I'm invested in the process. Like if you weren't invested in your process, we wouldn't have had Real Love, which I think probably would have been would have been a loss for the community that way, you know?
Yeah, it's so great to talk to you. I don't want to stop, but I guess we're coming toward the end.
Let's do it again, okay?
Yeah,
please, sir. This was great. Like, even just hearing these stories in the book, like, I'm so excited to read this. I'm super excited to read this.
Well, thank you. I want to close my part with quoting something from your book. And then ask you to lead a meditation. So you've written a few books, and most recently, the 2017 release book about things I will tell my daughter, in which you say, you were born with seeds of prosperity already planted inside of you long before you arrived. The magic you see and feel now has always been inherently yours. It is okay to own your goodness, your joy. Do not let others deflate the wonder in you. In moments of weakness, know and understand all that you need, you already have. You've already been given. You are equipped for this journey. Your spirit has been given the wings needed in order to travel this path. Your process, your practice, your learnings, all come from the in-betweens of your flying through the course that is your life. So thank you so much. I would love for you to lead us in some kind of reflection or meditation practice.
Yes. wow, Sharon, thank you. So I think I'm just going to ask for us to just be still, right? It's really important in this space to feel the breath and start at the bottom. If you can get what it feels like to feel the bottoms of your souls. And then in doubt. Then move to the tips of your toes. See what that feels like. Out. We can slowly start working our way up. No, you don't have to cling to anything, clench anything. Maybe you've had a hard day at work today, at home. things maybe didn't go your way. You can feel that in your calves, right? Just let all of that out. How can you give yourself grace in this moment? How can you give yourself peace in this moment? You can feel that in your knees. What's that feel like? What's the flavor of that? And then, breathe out. There's a lot going on in the world. What is our role? It's our responsibility. Right? Some of us don't know. Some of us want to know. All that is okay. Sometimes just the mere asking is the invitation. So let's look at our thighs. Then and breathe out. More breathing in, we're just kind of taking in everything that's here. You can hold 3 seconds or 5 seconds and just breathing it all away. Hips, what are we holding there? You know, what tension is in there? What interaction from last week are we still holding on to? No, let's breathe that in. Breathe it out. How can you forgive yourself in this moment? You know, maybe there was a thing that you wanted to do, but you forgot to do. Maybe there was a thing that you think you were supposed to do, but you didn't do. Maybe there's a thing that you did do, maybe you didn't do the best of what you define to be your capabilities. Maybe that's sitting in your pelvis. Just breathe it in. Breathe it out. And just try to think about how you can love yourself in this moment. What can you tell yourself? What can you give to yourself? Just breathe all that in. Breathe that out. Just breathe it in. Breathe it out. If you're sitting, standing, whatever, shake it all out. Shake out the remnants of today. this week, this month, this year. It's been a year for a lot of us. Some of us have lost people, lost things, lost opportunities. Some of us have gained some things. New insight, new friends, new relationships, new job. Whatever those things are, loss or gain, just hold on to those things. This breath, just let them go. Just let it all go.
That was really beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, Sharon. I mean, you are incredible. Like, I'm so glad I get to do life with you. It's awesome.
I'm so glad I get to get closer and closer to you. So please, let's do this again. Truly.
Yes, yes.
And Sharon, further, let's meet somewhere when yes, we can.
Yes, like, it's you. It's not even a question. You give me a time, I will be there. Absolutely.
Without Fantastic. Question. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. And to learn more about Joel's work, you can find him on social media at JoelAkamag.
Yeah, I know.
Definitely follow him on Twitter.
Yes, please.
And or you can follow me on Twitter, and it'll lead you right to him, because most of what I do is retweet him. Really. You will see amazing wisdom coming from him if you follow me on Twitter.
Yes.
Thanks to all of you listeners out there. This has been the Real Change series on the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, be happy, be healthy, and may you live with ease.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening. Real Change is available September 1st in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook formats. To receive a free meditation from the book, pre-order your copy today at realchangebook.com.